The second of the king's visits came just after the wonderful news of armistice and the day before the German fleet was due to surrender. On the 11th of November 1918, the armistice was signed. It seemed to come as a surprise and as a relief to everyone. We seemed to have got used to the war. When it began, we had all been well informed, back in the nursery at Devonport with copies of illustrated London news to cut out and colour and little flags to stick on maps to show the position of the Allied armies. But that was 4 years ago. We had since lost track of the war, but we were soon swept up by the excitement of everyone else. We had little flags to wave over the garden wall, and the crisis came at night when every ship in the fleet let off rockets and flares and fairy lights of red and green that they possessed, and they hooted their sirens at full pitch and on every conceivable note. We were taken out of bed to the front windows to watch and listen to the noise. Nobody would ever forget it, even my youngest brother Ver, who was only 4, did not. After we had gone back to bed, the noise went on and on, and was rather more terrifying than joyous. I thought, like fiends in hell. The King's second visit to the destroyers came less than 10 days later. There were 8,000 men on parade. I cannot imagine how they found room for so many on Port Edgar's little square. This was my father's affair, though Admiral Beatty was also present as Commander-in-Chief. When the parade was over, Admiral Beatty had to dash back to the Queen Elizabeth to receive the King on board. As that gave time to spare, the King and my father waited behind a shed smoking cigarettes and chatting. The King took the opportunity to let off steam about F.E. Smith, Lord Birkenhead. He always remembered this occasion when he and my father met at later dates. The King was finally taken off to Queen Elizabeth in the little destroyer Oak, which was the flagship's constant attendant. This all took place on the day before the surrender of the German High Seas Fleet on 21st of November 1918. Before that, a single German ship anchored off Inchkeith, bringing, I suppose, staff officers to discuss the procedure. Conversation at home was beginning to be more relaxed, and I heard some talk of how surprised these officers were at the supplies on our ships. The Germans were very short of necessities, particularly soap. The relaxation meant that our father was at home more in the daytime. Before that, he only came home to sleep, and we heard more talk. Much of this concerned about what could be expected when the fleets met. Did the Germans really mean to surrender, or would they open fire? Was the whole thing a trick? I think our officers half hoped it was, and a few believed they would really surrender. They did not at all like the idea of a navy tamingly surrender. My father said they were ready for any eventuality, but the talk alarmed me. I was scared to death of the Germans and was very relieved when I was excused from going out in a launch to witness the surrender. Though I realise now that I missed one of the opportunities of my life. I'd been having a lot of bad sore throats and was not considered fit to go to sea in November weather. When the 21st came, my father and the destroyers left long before daylight to get to the rendezvous halfway across the North Sea. His ship, the Castor, and the destroyers led the Grand Fleet out of the Forth and was the first to make contact with the High Seas Fleet. The civilian party with some journalists, Lady Beatty, her younger son Peter, my mother and my brothers left about breakfast time. I stayed at home in my parents' large bed in the front bedroom to watch as the big grey ships came down one by one from Rosyth in their unhurried and dignified way. A stately procession heading for the middle arch of the bridge, which was the only one that could take them. I probably had the best of it. My father once said he would have loved to have been ashore to watch the fleet come and go, for he never could. But it was a long day, and the house was very quiet and empty. So was the firth and the street. I suppose someone must have given me some lunch. Then at last the same procession of big ships came gliding back again, safe and sound, and passed to their anchorage at Rosyth. The German ships were left to berth even further down than the Americans, and the destroyers had to bring up the rear and see them safely anchored. The launch, or was it a tug, which had been out as far as May Island, came back with the family cold and seasick, but intact. There had been no shooting, and I was relieved that I was not the only one left alive, as it had seemed during the day. My father had returned to the Forth with 170 destroyers under his command, including the 49 German ones in the centre. When he gave the general signal, "Anchor instantly," using the commercial flag code for the benefit of the Germans, he wondered if so many warships would ever again respond to one signal. The next day, the Grand Fleet destroyers conducted the German ships up to Scapa Flow, where there was a lot more space, and I never saw them, but I was not sorry. The big ships followed a few days later. There, 6 months later, their crews scuttled them, at last performing one of the actions that had been expected of them. And that, from all I heard, was an immense relief to their naval guards. In all this pageant, there was no sign of a submarine, although they had been the worst enemy, and I cannot remember, among all the ships in the Forth, ever seeing a submarine.